Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Beaver. This is the This Thing Is Working show. It is our chance to do an update, a midterm on the Affordable Care Act after the end of the sign-up period. Special thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. And with me to debate the Affordable Care Act and some other issues affecting the health care of our nation and around the world, from the University of Kentucky, communications guru Rick Phillips, to talk about, first of all, our web presence. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know you can get the audio of the shows at WMKY.org. That's right, WMKY.org. They're there. They're in MP3 format. You do have to find the Health Matters page on the WMKY website, but we're certainly there. You'll find the more recent shows. They're in MP3 format. You can download them, save them to your MP3 player, to your iPhone, whatever it is you listen to your music on. And like I said, just listen to Tony over and over and over. Because that's what the MP3 files are there for, right, Tony? Isn't that right?
Well, I guess so. I mean, I can't think of anything else you do with
it. I mean, Health Matters is, you really should listen to it 2 or 3 times a week, right? Or is that asking too much?
I don't do that, but sure. Why not?
So, WMKY.org, go there, get the audio, again, MP3 format. After that, you want to get interactive with Health Matters, jump on over to Facebook, go to /HM Radio Show, that is facebook.com/HM Radio Show. You can always do a search for HM Radio Show, one word, and there you'll find a fan page for Health Matters. We do post on there. There's research that shows up, both makes it on the show, and some of it's just interesting, we want to get out in front of folks. Sometimes we post some relevant news of the times, things you can look for in the future that might be coming down the pike. Again, we would ask you to leave a comment, tell us what you want us to talk about, show topics, what do you think of the show, what do you think of Tony? All comments are welcome on there. And I do the screening, so I'll delete them if they're about me. Isn't that right?
Again, I
can't do that, but that's okay.
Okay.
We won't tell anybody.
Our sponsor for today's show, the Society of Expert Soap Opera Watchers, that's the Seesaw, and we have
now,
their
Now, what
chips.
Do you know about soap operas?
Listen, I am just a shill for the Society. As far as I'm concerned, all the expertise lies there, but they did want to sponsor the show, and I agree. I was reading about comas, and it occurred to me who is most
Which,
likely—
Which, let's be honest, is a very common thing in soap operas.
Yes, that's the point.
They need them.
Soap opera characters go into a coma, and if they are not renewing their contract, then they never come out of the coma. But if they are renewing their contract, then they wake up and they suddenly remember the torrid love affair between Stefano and Marlena, or somebody like that. You know, that's the sort of thing that soap
operas
do.
That's what we're told.
That's what
we,
yeah.
Because, I mean, we don't watch soap operas.
Yes, I mean, now, I don't even need to lie about this.
Do you have DirecTV now? Do you have actually satellite TV?
I have nothing. I have an antenna on top of my roof. I get the local affiliates.
Because, in your honor, I think they did create the soap opera network or the soap opera channel. So you can go back and watch the day's soap operas later on at night when, you know, you get home and you're wound down and you're ready to sit and watch TV. Just throw on a good soap opera or maybe 3 or 4 of them and just enjoy life. Of course, it might put you in a coma.
In a coma. And what is a coma? Coma is unarousable unresponsiveness. You're unresponsive when you're asleep. However, if I yell at you, pinch you, do something like that, it will wake you up. But you cannot arouse a person who's in a coma. They're unresponsive to the environment. They look like they're in a sleep, but they cannot be awakened by any means.
Haven't you ever worked with people like that?
These people they cannot be. I've had people that cannot be motivated by any means, yes, but I don't know about awakened, and that's a whole different thing. Comas can last, most people in a coma will come out in 2 to 4 weeks. I mean, this takes a while for the brain to recover from whatever insult that the brain had. It is not a permanent state, but either people recover or they don't, and if they don't, then in most cases, they die. People with severe brain injury transition to something called a persistent vegetative state, more about that later. That is an after effect of a coma. Now, let's talk about the types of coma you can get. One is, they call it a toxic or metabolic encephalopathy. Something went wrong with the brain. Now, this could be anything from an infection to taking some type of toxic substance to the brain. Even with this, you can get that as a result of, say, trauma and swelling of the brain. those type of things do damage to the brain. And unfortunately, and we've seen this time and time again, even among celebrities around the world, the experts can't predict when they're in a coma, if or when they will come out.
Right.
It's very difficult. Another one, a very common form, about half the people get the toxic metabolic, but the other very common form is something called anoxic. Something disturbs the flow of oxygen to the brain, usually a stroke, a heart attack, a heart rhythm disturbance, low blood pressure, things like that. Then there is the persistent vegetative state. It is a state of unconsciousness, not arousable, doesn't appear to be aware of surroundings, but they do have a sleeping and waking cycle. The brain, that is, will wake up, the brain will go to sleep, but there isn't any other sign of function. And the details of that are still being worked out. There is a type called locked-in syndrome, which is not really a coma. People are responsive, and they have a normal mind, but they're paralyzed. And so that's called locked-in syndrome, and then finally brain death. In this case, there's an irreversible coma. People will not come out of that. You know, Rick, several years ago, I was seeing a man in the emergency room, and I noticed his wife was focused on me, and she did not seem happy. And she recalled that years ago, I had taken care of him. He apparently, his heart had stopped. And we had managed to resuscitate him. And for a while, there was swelling in the brain. He was in a coma. And I maintained him and took care of him until he began to improve from his coma. And then I sent him to a hospital in Lexington to have his heart problems addressed.
Right.
And I don't remember much about the guy, but I had provided him, I think, a reasonable level and standard of care. But what his wife remembers was that I just left him in the bed, did nothing for him. And thank goodness they were able to get him to Lexington, where he woke up and the doctors took care of him.
Right.
And so I think there was that fundamental misunderstanding about what a coma is. I really could not have him undergo any type of heart surgery while he was still in a coma. We had to first address the cause of the coma. And really, I provided him with supportive care and allowed him to wake up, and then we negotiated his problems. But she had an entirely different memory. And so I have always been sensitive about comas since that time, realizing that if you don't understand this thing, it seems very puzzling to you that the doctors seem to be doing nothing when actually they are providing support and we're watching for that waking. But we do not have a way. We cannot shock people into being awake. We cannot medicate them into being awake or anything else.
But let's be honest, Tony. If we did, the term coma itself probably wouldn't be as well known or probably wouldn't be the same, because you wouldn't see people in a coma. I mean, you hear of somebody being in a coma, you naturally want to tend to, or at least I do, to think of a long-term. You know, we're talking about a week, 2 weeks, months, maybe years people spend in a coma. I think if you had the ability as a physician to do some treatment or medication that would bring somebody out of a state of coma, then we wouldn't actually have that anymore, because we would always bring them out of it.
Yeah.
So just the fact that you go into it, logically to me, says we don't have any way to get you out of it.
That's our sponsor, the Society of Expert Soap Opera Watchers, the Seesaw.
It's kind of like Health Matters. You just got to wait it out.
And their tips on how to determine if a person in a coma will actually wake up. First article does not come from the United States, and that is a very important
fact. How typical is that?
Of that article. Well, I've actually
Since when do you read American journals?
In between times. Yeah, sometimes.
I mean, granted, obviously you bring the more interesting ones to the show.
Right.
So what does that say? It means America's articles are not interesting.
Searching the world for new medical information. This one comes from Sweden, and that is very important. Sweden, the latitude of Sweden is in the 60s. That would be the equivalent of Alaska, of the northern part of Canada. And keep that in mind as you read this. This was a study of the melanoma of a group of Swedish women who were at risk for melanoma. They looked at several lifestyle factors, including sun exposure, in 29,000, almost 30,000 Swedish women. They followed them for 20 years, first recruited in 1990. The women were aged 25 to 64. And what they found was that all-cause mortality was lower in the people who were sun exposed. Now, Rick, you know, I mean, if I ask you that question, I have two people here. They have similar health, similar smoking habits, similar diet. One of them spends a lot of time outdoors in the sun. The other one stays inside all the time. Which one do you think will live longer? I think in our heart, we believe there's something about being outdoors that is good.
The way nature intended it.
Right. But keep in mind, our rules right now that come from our dermatologists, from our healthcare experts, tell us not to get out in the sun.
Right.
So,
isn't it really, I mean, after all the years we've been talking about this, isn't it just the word moderation apply here?
Don't we got to
figure out where that moderation level lies?
Now, here's the questions they ask you to determine the people that got more sun exposure. Four questions. One, how often do you sunbathe during the summertime?
Oh, all the time.
Never 1 to 14 times, 15 to 30 times, over 30 times. Number two.
I'll answer that if you will.
Do you sunbathe during the winter? such as when you go on holiday.
Who?
Yeah. So when you go on holiday, do you? And I will say, when I go on holiday, I go somewhere south.
Do you go on holiday?
I do. In the winter, I go on holiday. I don't know why that's funny. I just think it is. Three, do you use a tanning bed? Never. 1 to 3 times a year, 4 to 10 times a year, over 10 times a year. So they, if they do use a tanning bed, I mean, I know some young women who use tanning beds almost on a daily or certainly a weekly basis, 10 times a year, and not that many is a low use of tanning bed frequency. And you go abroad on holiday to swim and sunbathe every 1 to 2 years, once every year, 2 or more times a year. Those are your four questions.
Well, the abroad took it out.
Well, and again, Sweden, if you're going to swim or sunbathe, you probably need to leave Sweden. That's the message that I got from that.
But is going to England going abroad?
Yeah, sure. Anywhere south of Sweden, I would assume.
Really? See, I would think abroad to me means, well, I guess true, it does mean leaving the
country.
Yeah,
we're surrounded by oceans.
Yeah.
So when we go abroad, we go across an ocean, but you don't have to do that.
Okay.
Now, this is what they said in their discussion. First of all, we know there's a seasonal variation in heart disease and stroke. More heart disease, more strokes occur in the winter.
Okay.
So maybe that's because of the cold, dry air. Maybe it's because we have lower vitamin D levels from lower sun exposure. We don't know. Another statistic that they pointed out was that sailors, naval men actually, have higher rates of skin cancer, but lower overall cause mortality from other forms of cancer. Now, first of all, people in the Navy tend to be fairly healthy, and the level of sun exposure in the Navy will vary depending on your job. So maybe that means something, maybe it doesn't. They think, well, possibly UV radiation makes you feel better. Being out in the sunshine, if you're in Sweden, is a good thing. Maybe it raises your vitamin D levels. Maybe it increases nitrous oxide in the skin that lowers your blood pressure and does nice things for your heart. But they're not certain. They mentioned the Australian guidelines, SunSmart guidelines, which most countries follow, may be appropriate in Australia, but maybe not in Sweden. If that's the case, then I would also make an argument that maybe we should individualize our sun exposure guidelines and our sun exposure recommendations here in the United States. Maybe then Kentucky would be different than, say, Florida, which would be different than, say, South Dakota.
So the SPF factor might have a geolocator line or something like that?
Well, you know, I don't want to make things complicated. One nice thing about it, if you just say, don't do this, then everybody remembers it. If you say, well, if you live in this area, do this some, but don't do it too much, it gets more complicated. So it's easy to make these pronouncements. But with our pronouncements, certainly as you go north, at some point, sun exposure no longer becomes the life-threatening event that it does at the equator. At some point, it actually probably is more beneficial than harmful, but I don't know where it is. Speaking of things I don't know where they are, I'm not sure where our second fractional portion is. Why not give us a break? We'll go find it. You come back. We'll present it. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the This Thing Is Working show. This is our salute to the end of the enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act, at least the first enrollment period.
The end of the initial enrollment period.
That's correct. Medicaid is ongoing enrollment at any time. The exchange plans will begin enrollment in the fall, and meanwhile, they're now crunching the numbers. And let me say, the number enrolled does not equal the number who actually have health insurance. Some people may enroll. They're estimating up to 15 to 20% of people will enroll and actually not pay for the plan. I am aware of some people who have decided not to pay for the plan they signed up for. They're trying to make some switches. And so this is still really a moving target. However, the enrollment did, I think it was actually over 8 million the last time I heard an update. Our sponsor for the second time, the Society of Experts Soap Opera Watchers, The Seesaw, reminding you how to tell if a comatose character on a soap opera will survive the coma. And
isn't it based on ratings?
Well, it's based on ratings and also contract. You can have a highly rated character who wants more money, and they tend not to survive
they're
the coma.
They're never coming out.
They're never
going
to wake
coma.
Up. As a matter of fact, they'll probably just stay in the back room on the edge of your view so you can't see that it's actually the same person.
All you're ever going to hear out of them the rest of the show is beep, beep.
No, you won't hear that because if you hear that, it's going to go flatline. A coma is defined as unarousable unresponsiveness. They are unresponsive to their environment, and you cannot make them responsive by yelling at them, by shocking them, by pinching them, or anything else. And it can last, on the average, people who come out of a coma come out of it in the first 2 to 4 weeks. Some stay longer. We mentioned several types of coma, either a toxic, a metabolic, traumatic encephalopathy, where the brain is swelling and damaged and takes time to recover from that. Anoxic, which is interruption of blood flow, heart rhythm disturbance, blockage of an artery, and so forth. Persistent vegetative state, severe unconsciousness, unaware of surroundings. They do have a waking and sleeping cycle of their brain, but that's about all that we see. Locked-in syndrome, in this case, they are wide awake. They're alert. They have a normal mind, but they are paralyzed. Only thing they can do is move their eye muscles. And then the other type, brain death. Several causes, trauma. That is a very, very common cause of trauma, which leads to swelling. Sometimes you can get swelling of the brain without trauma, electrolyte imbalance, hormones, lack of oxygen, bleeding into the brain. People who, especially who have high blood pressure or people who have an aneurysm can burst and go into a coma. Stroke, very common cause of a coma. Blood sugar. You can have a coma when your blood sugar levels, either they stay very high and cause dehydration of the brain. You can lead to a rapidly correctable coma in most cases if the blood sugar drops too low. As soon as they wake up when you give them extra sugar. Low oxygen or oxygen deprivation can do it, and also some types of infections can cause a coma. So obviously there are many causes, lots of opportunities for a soap opera character to acquire a coma.
Yeah, from a TV standpoint, it's a pretty easy thing to get into.
Right.
It's much more difficult to get out of it.
Right. So we have not had, in the past, we have not had a way to really determine, as I said in the first fractional portion, most times we just wait. You know, if we know if the insult wasn't too severe, we are optimistic. If it was very severe, let's say they were found down and we don't know how long they were without a pulse, we tend to be more pessimistic. But in our third fractional portion, I'll tell you some new research that indicates maybe we will be able to figure out which comatose people will be able to wake up and there'll be a better answer at hand.
Wouldn't that be neat if there were some indicators that would have you help you along?
Right. I think we're figuring things out, and I think that face-off I had with the woman who was convinced that I had not treated her husband while I was waiting for the coma to end, I think those type of things will be a thing of the past eventually. Not comas. Comas will still be there, but we'll have better predictor methods. That's our sponsor, the Society of Expert Soap Opera Watchers, the Seesaw, reminding you comas occur commonly on soap operas. And we will tell you a way of understanding who will wake up.
We've had a couple of shows where one of us was in a coma.
Yeah. Well, first of all, health matters would have to be one of the causes of a coma.
Well, yeah. But
how many times you've gone unresponsive while you're listening to our show?
Man.
Yep. Got that. Now, in the first fraction portion, we talked some about the skin guidelines.
Right.
And if you get far enough north, it appears that being out in the sun actually lowers your mortality rather than raises it. And I'm not sure where that cut point is. That cut point may go through Kentucky or it may not. I think, though, the idea of adopting universal, severe, fair-skinned, close-to-the-equator guidelines for everyone in the world is probably not a good idea. So we've got to have some sense about that. And as I said, and Rick, you agreed with me, when you talk about people who are staying indoors more or staying outdoors more, even if they have the same health, same risk factors, you just have this sense that being outdoors is a good and healthy thing to do, even though it's actually prescribed by most people who work with skin disease.
Well, I think, you know, there's a belief, or at least maybe a perception, that being outside causes you to burn calories. I mean, you're doing something. And I'm not saying you can't in the house, but I'm saying there's just this perception that you're walking around, you're hiking, you're driving, you're riding. I mean, you're mowing, you're doing something. I mean, very few people just go out and sit, right?
Yeah.
I mean, my 50-inch flat-screen TV isn't outside.
Yep.
And so I think we associate outside with a less sedentary lifestyle. Thus, it makes sense that you would be more healthy, but I don't know.
Well, here's another pronouncement from experts that is really undergoing some serious review. If you remember, back several years ago, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force questioned the value of routine mammogram screening for women in their 40s.
Right.
And if you remember, this aroused an absolute firestorm of criticism. As a matter of fact, there were several in Congress that vowed to disband the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force.
Yeah, it was. I remember that there was a lot of controversy over that because, you know, it was kind of a foreign concept from the previous recommendations.
Right. Well, in April, it goes further. On April 16th, the New England Journal of Medicine, the Swiss Medical Board, this is an advisory board. They don't make the laws of Switzerland, but they do give expert advice. The Swiss Medical Board recommended that Switzerland stop introducing new mammography screening programs and phase out their existing mammogram screening programs.
Ooh.
Published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Now, this is a very brief summary of the facts that they looked at. They pointed out that most of the recommendations for mammography came from studies that are now 50 years old.
Right.
Certainly, we've had advances in the treatment of breast cancer. Certainly, the nature of breast cancer has changed. Shouldn't we be updating those recommendations? That bothered them. Here are the numbers, and this was from a Canadian study. They said after 25 years of follow-up in this study, 106 out of 484 screen-detected cancers, that's almost 22% of them, were overdiagnosed. These are things that were not going to kill the women, yet they were diagnosed as cancer. And that's right. I mean, based on the tissue, they looked like a cancer, but they weren't going to spread. And these women then, diagnosed with breast cancer, they were treated unnecessarily. Needless surgery, needless radiation, needless chemotherapy, needless combinations. Now, in addition to that Canadian study that showed that there was overdiagnosis, there was a review of 10 studies, more than 500,000 women, no clear evidence suggesting a benefit of mammography screening on overall mortality. That is, you may be able to lower breast cancer, you cannot lower it to the point that people live longer. They just die of something different. The best case, they said, a small reduction in breast cancer death was really diluted by deaths from other causes. Worst case, the reduction was canceled out by deaths due to the harms of screening and overtreatment of people who weren't going to die of breast cancer. Now, they had three conclusions from their review of the literature, the modern literature on breast cancer. First, the debate about screening was based on reanalysis of the same outdated trials. The modest benefit might not even be found today because of changes. Second, the relative risk reduction of 20%, that's what we say.
Right.
People who get mammographic screening regularly have a 20% lower risk of dying, cited by most expert panels, comes at the price of a considerable amount of overdiagnosis. I mean, almost every woman who has had mammograms for over 10 years is going to have something show up, and they're going to have at least the anxiety of a repeat, but in many cases it's biopsies, and apparently in a number of cases, 22% in the Canadian study was a thing that looks like a cancer but doesn't act like a cancer. And then third, and this bothered them, there is a big discrepancy between most women's perceptions of the benefits of mammography and the actual benefits in reality. Most women are overly optimistic. And again, it's based on pronouncements from experts. Now, as you might imagine, this was not a popular editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Oh, no.
There are, right now, the scientific community is sort of divided. Some people feel like the benefits have been overstated. Other people are worried and are taking to the airways to warn women. The government, you know, the big nebulous government, the experts are trying to fiddle with your right to have mammography and to have your life saved from it. It's really difficult. Again, if the overdiagnosis is right, there are a bunch of women who are alive today who think they are alive because of mammograms, when in fact they underwent a lot of needless procedures and they would have lived anyway.
And there's a certain percentage of them that were going to experience complications and have problems associated with their treatment that really wasn't even required.
The American College of Radiology, the Society of Breast Imaging, issued a joint statement. The deadly consequences of the author's breast cancer screening recommendations to the Swiss government may take years to become evident, and they cited several studies showing it has a mortality benefit. They said, and again, I'm quoting an article about the American College of Radiology recommendations, American women should pay close attention to the breast cancer screening policies that may be considered for them. And obviously that the implication there is that there may be a change in effect. Now, Rick, you know, again, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, they first looked at this about mammograms, very unpopular recommendation. If you remember, they also, they looked at prostate cancer and concluded that our screening programs for prostate cancer were, in the general public, not effective. Now, if you know someone who's everyone in their family got breast cancer, if they have a first-degree relative, a mother, a sister who had breast cancer, then we're not talking about them. What we're talking about is people at average risk who undergo the regular screenings. There is controversy. Now, if you ask me, point blank, if you're in my clinic and you ask me, I am still recommending screening mammograms. I don't understand entirely this change, but what I am seeing is the beginning of a real serious
reappraisal of the benefits of mammography. And we just had an article in one of the U.S. medical journals about individualizing recommendations rather than making a blanket recommendation for everybody to get screened every year starting at age 50.
Yeah, I don't know, Tony. It's tough because, you know, it is just ingrained in us as a society that mammograms save lives, and that I'm not suggesting that they don't. Based on this research, there are a lot of people that are suggesting that. And to me, in I have to believe that a baseline mammogram, and then come back a year later, and if you do a second one, and you can compare the two, and there is major change, or there's something that's changed, wouldn't that be something you'd want to worry about and could screen for? But I, you know, we don't do them that way. We do the first one, and then we look at that first one and say, well, there's something. Well, and I know this probably isn't related very, very closely, but when I tried to join the Army, I couldn't get in the Army because I had spots on my lungs. And those spots had been there forever, but they showed up on the x-ray that I did for my entrance exam. And I had to actually go see a secondary physician, get a secondary x-ray, and then they basically say, yeah, it's probably been there forever. Don't worry about it. And so to me, the idea of taking something and having it change over time would be a far better screening technique. But, you know, you don't typically see people talking about that in this particular area. So I really don't know what's going on. I mean, it's hard to say.
There, you just can't help but have an opinion. If you feel that mammogram saved your life, it's going to be very difficult to accept the fact that someone would be phasing them out.
If you think a mammogram saved anybody you know's life, you're going to take that in consideration. Again, we're not talking about and I'm just going to use it because it's very visible right now, and that's Angelina Jolie. I mean, here she undergoes a double mastectomy to try to prevent it from happening because she's got a deep family history of it. You know, that's not what we're talking about here.
Absolutely not. She has that BRCA gene, which has a very high predilection for turning into breast cancer. Again, if you have that, if you have first-degree family members, again, mother or sister that has had breast cancer, we are not talking about you. The risk is way too high. For the average woman, I think this is a nice time. I don't think that physicians are entirely prepared to have these conversations, but I think it is a nice time to start reading, to talk with your doctor, to look at this editorial and watch the response to it among U.S. physicians and figure out where you stand on this, because it's a tricky area. My personal recommendations, even looking at this, I am not ready to make that kind of wholesale change.
Well, nor is most everybody in America.
Right. And I did on PSA screening for prostate cancer. I looked at those numbers and it just didn't hold up for me. I stopped recommending it routinely in people who are at average risk. Mammograms, it's still a little more complicated to me. The number of people who die is higher, and they die at a young age as opposed to prostate cancer, which mainly affects older men. And so I'm not ready to make that change. I think there's too much risk. But certainly you're going to keep an open mind on this and watch for developments. Well, I want to be truthful. I want to be faithful to the title of this show and talk some about the Affordable Care Act.
Let's don't.
Okay.
I mean, it's work. Can we just say it kind of works?
8 million people.
Okay, it works.
Use the exchanges to sign up for insurance. Again, signing up, not the same as actually completing the deal by purchasing it. Also, signing up does not mean that you have insurance. It just means you're signed up for insurance. The way I heard it put was, well, everybody on the Titanic now has a ticket. I mean, obviously, this is a person who is kind of anti-insurance. But we have signed up. We have not actually seen the Affordable Care Act. We have seen the sign up for the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
It is certainly having an impact. I do not mean to say it's no impact, but still, we'll see how it works out when people actually start using it. The uninsured rate fell below 16% the first quarter of 2014. It was as high as 18%. Now, that's still higher. The rate was still a full percentage point lower before the Great Recession after 2008-2009. So in that sense, we haven't gone anywhere. We've simply moved back to 2005 in terms of our uninsured rates. However, in this economy, to make an improvement in the rates of uninsured, to lower the rates of uninsured, even if we still can't get back to where we were 10 years ago, is not necessarily, I think that's an accomplishment.
Well, we had to stop the curve from going the way it was going, right? I mean, I think the trend was going the wrong direction, and at least now they've got it going in the right direction. Will it be complete success? Who knows?
Yeah. Now, this is a report card from the editor of Modern Healthcare named Merrill Guzner. For his universal coverage gives him a B. One of the problems is private employers are dropping healthcare coverage as people become eligible to sign up for individual policies. And again, overall, the job growth is down, and there may be a rise in employment offering no benefits. It's really hard to tell how this is going to work in terms of universal coverage. I think it's a little bit too early. He gives him a B in terms of insurance expansion. Medicaid, half the uninsured were supposed to be covered by Medicaid expansion. And again, 25 states out of the 50 did not expand. 25 did. Texas and Florida, two very populous states, did not. And so from a standpoint of Medicaid expansion, that did not work. C from Mr. Guzner of Modern Healthcare.
C.
Yeah, you know when people give report cards, they always give really bad grades.
Right.
I would not want to get a report card in a magazine because they always grade something.
Well, how are the, what do you think of those physician report cards? Are they pretty mean?
Right now, with our current ability to record both the complication rates and diagnosis and the complexity of illness, if you see a physician report card online, it's not quite accurate enough. It's a lot better than it was when they first started, but still more work needs to go in. The problem is sometimes physicians get either they have sicker patients, poorer patients. We've been able to adjust for illness, but we still don't adjust for the economic status of the person you're treating. And also, we still have problems with overlapping. Someone else actually takes care of the patient, and they keep the name of the person who first admitted them. So now the accuracy's not quite there on their physician report cards. Back to the Affordable Care Act, one more thing. Delivery system reform. Again, the reforms in the Affordable Care Act are starting to reduce healthcare expenses. Not sure about that. Most people now, many people have high deductibles, and they're simply saving their money. One thing's clear, healthcare costs have remained steady.
Right.
But I got to say, we were just about at the end of what we could charge people anyway back a few years ago. I mean, I think the Affordable Care Act has kind of cemented that things must change. But what we're seeing is not necessarily Affordable Care Act reforms taking place, but more the entire healthcare delivery system is changing pretty rapidly. And that may be a response to the Affordable Care Act, or it may be a response to market conditions.
Could just be time to stop talking about it.
It could be. Why don't you take a break and stay tuned for our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the This Thing Is Working show, our salute to the Affordable Care Act, and a kind of a look back on the first few months of the Affordable Care Act now that the sign-up period, the initial sign-up period has ended.
Give it 20 minutes and we won't be working.
True. Our sponsor for today's show for the last time, the Society of Expert Soap Opera Watchers, The Seesaw, telling you how to decide if your comatose character will survive or will never come out of the coma.
What's your favorite one? What's your favorite soap opera?
You know, I don't even have one.
Come on.
No. I mean, what can I say? I don't watch any of them.
You have to be a General Hospital guy.
Okay. To my knowledge, never seen
General
Hospital.
Don't you remember Rick Springfield in the 80s? Wasn't he on General Hospital?
Not a clue.
I'm pretty sure he was.
Now, of all my weaknesses, this is one that is I'm pretty strong at. I do not have
See, now, this is for all the people that I know that tell me to my face, I listen to your show. And I suspect deep down, they don't listen.
Yep.
They listen to the first 5 minutes. They don't hang in for that third and final fractional portion. Here's a tidbit of trivia about Rick and his senior year of high school. During that summer before I started my senior year, I was addicted to The Young and the Restless. Every day at 11, I watched it.
Okay.
Now, but that, granted, that was 30 years ago.
Yeah, but you were a high school boy.
You know, the funny thing is the people haven't changed.
You have some issues. I'm just saying.
Hey, you're the one who invited me here.
Some issues.
Now the question is, I want to know how many people that tell me, give me all that, you know, lip service, hey, I listen. Next time I'm going to ask you, tell me one thing about my senior year.
All right. Rick listens to soap operas his senior year of high school.
No,
how
I did
weird
not watch
that?
Them. I watched them.
Fair enough. That's even weirder.
But you are a General Hospital. You're a Rick Springfield kind of guy.
What is a coma? A coma is unarousable unresponsiveness. You are unresponsive to your surroundings, and you cannot be aroused by yelling, by pain, by anything else. Now, the study we were talking about was reported out in The Lancet, was conducted at a hospital in Belgium. 81 patients in a minimally conscious state, 41 have been diagnosed as being in a vegetative state. And remember, a vegetative state means there is a severe unconsciousness. They are unaware of their surroundings. They do have some waking and sleeping cycles, but no other evidence of brain function. They used a PET scan. Now, PET scan, as opposed to a CAT scan or an MRI, PET scan actually, positron emission tomography, looks at the function of whatever it's investigating. So I can take a picture of your brain with an MRI scanner or a CAT scanner. You may be alive or dead. Your brain will look very similar on a CAT scan or an MRI scan. On the other hand, with PET scanning, you actually see how the brain is functioning. It lights up when there is a higher metabolic rate of the tissue, and you can tell its function. So they did the PET scan, and they actually looked to see whether or not the brain was functioning, and found that a PET scan was about 74% accurate in predicting whether a patient would recover during a one-year follow-up study. A third of the patients whom doctors said were unresponsive showed brain activity similar to these minimally conscious patients that we sometimes see in the hospital, and those were the ones who, nine out of 20 of those, or nearly half of those, recovered consciousness. So the PET scans may be the key to diagnosing and giving a prognosis in people with serious brain injuries, people who are comatose. Now, it's not ready yet. Do not ask your doctor to run a PET scan on Aunt Sarah, who's been comatose and is in the nursing home, because it is very expensive. We don't have widespread PET scanning capabilities, but the idea of relying strictly on photos, anatomic looks, as opposed to a functional look,
I mean, in the future,
that will be strange.
There's chemistry going on along with the visual, you know?
Right. And so with a lot of these things, you know, we've had people do everything from read magazines to actually have sex in the scanner and look at what part of the brain lights up, what is developed.
Can you imagine leading that research project?
It's weird. I don't even want to think about it.
I mean, let's don't go there.
That's our sponsor, the Society of Expert Soap Opera Watchers, the Seesaw. And there may be some new technology which will help us to determine who wakes up from a coma. Right now, we look at the extent of the insult to the brain and try to make our best guess. But it can take a month to wake up if you're gonna, and it can take longer than that to figure out that
Tony, before you get too far away from that, and I may be putting you on the spot, hopefully I'm not. I mean, what do you think is about an average time people stay in a coma? Is it, you know, 3 days, 10 days, a month? I mean, I know that you don't have any stats right in front of you. It's probably what's your gut feeling on that?
A lot of the things we'll see at St. Clair, where I work, it's a smaller hospital. And the things over the years we've seen, people who had a heart attack, had a cardiac arrest and so forth, many of them will come in and they really will not be themselves. I may be able to pinch them and they move or something like that. But in terms of actually waking up, in many cases, it takes a week.
Clinical diagnosis there would be a coma, a state of coma.
In this case, they're we would call them minimally conscious. That is, they are aware of their surroundings, but they can't talk to you. They can't follow commands because of their brain has been insulted. And that happens. It starts swelling, and it does not function normally. Now, people who are actually in a coma, completely unresponsive, we don't see that many at a community hospital. And I'd have to defer to the judgment of people in the bigger centers on that. Back to the Affordable Care Act, just a couple of thoughts on that. One, there was a physician named Gary Present who works at USC. And he gave his report card on access. He said, yes, we've got more people who have insurance. However, the insurance plans are trimming doctors off, and they're also, with their high deductibles, they inhibit access. He gave them a C, and they've gotten a lot of C's. Benefits, the mandated minimum benefits package, prevention and maternal health, he gave them a B. Now, I want to say one thing about prevention. You know, supposedly, the exchange plans are supposed to cover all preventative care without charging you a copay. They pay for the entire thing.
Right, right.
The problem is, if you get, let's say, a mammogram. A mammogram will be covered as preventative care for a woman. If they find something on the mammogram, then all the additional diagnostic tests they run, the follow-up scans.
There is copay for that.
There is a copay. That's no longer preventative care. You're actually treating a nodule. So that is one thing to keep in mind as you think about the preventative care. Confidence, yes, for people with pre-existing illnesses, now you know that you will not lose your insurance. And a lot of people made a lot of decisions based on whether or not they could keep their benefits, many times not able to change jobs to move to things like that, and that is gone. So confidence, he said, that looked good. But however, since it looks like the changing regulations and cost may actually deprive you of your insurance rather than your medical condition, he did not think that we've made much progress at all there. D. Price. Cost of healthcare going down, but price and the deductibles are high. C. Quality, he said D. Again, we have access, but there's so much change right now, so many doctors retiring, actually being able to see the same doctor, did not think that was so. And then finally, on medical records, they got a B because we all have electronic health records now. However, those electronic records really don't talk to each other, which is unfortunate. Now, let me talk just a little bit.
You can do whatever you'd like, Tony.
Okay,
you're the host.
Moment, about the local situation. You know I work in free clinics.
Yes.
I work in one here in Moorhead called the People's Clinic. There's one in Owingsville, one county over called the New Hope Clinic. In a good way, these clinics have been emptied by the Affordable Care Act. Most of our patients are now eligible for the expanded Medicaid. Now, keep in mind, Kentucky embraced the Affordable Care Act. We created our own exchange. We expanded our Medicaid, and many of my free clinic patients are now on Medicaid where they can get better care, and they have access to a lot more care than I was able to give them in a free clinic. It has had a major change in our operations. These clinics are not closed. We were at a board meeting, and they pointed out donations are dropping off. The drug companies are no longer providing free medication. recommendations because they figure everybody should have insurance. Most people in the community say, well, these clinics are probably, they don't need to be in existence anymore. The clinics are running right now about half what they were before, but they are still seeing patients and still could use your help. The people that are there, it's a different clientele. Again, the Medicaid-eligible people are gone, but there are people who are having difficulty making ends meet and still come to the free clinics. Interestingly enough, again, talking to the folks at St. Clair, the emergency department at St. Clair, now keep in mind we've had horrible weather, which has really had an impact on volume and numbers, but the emergency department did not get overwhelmed. Now, maybe this summer, as more people actually pay for their policies and get insurance, we may see a huge rush to the emergency room. But at least at St. Clair, and I think in general conversations in most places, the ER is not being overwhelmed by new patients, newly insured patients.
Would they find their way into the ER, Tony, or would they find their way into a primary care system somewhere?
Well, you know, I think they would find their way into a primary care system. The primary care systems are pretty full in our region, but again, they are not swamped.
Right.
Part of this is, again, it's early. We've signed up, but we don't necessarily all have working insurance policies yet. Part of it was bad weather, so we'll have to wait a little bit longer to see.
It just seems to me that patients are going to show up in the ER almost to some extent regardless of their medical payment condition because it's a trauma-based area.
Right. If you're in a car crash, it doesn't matter what your insurance is. You really got to get
care. But those primary care clinics, urgent care clinics, those kinds of things, I would think they would be certainly seeing a lot more business in this region.
And they may as time passes. Early on, they're not swamped, put it that way. And that's what Massachusetts found was that their wait times for an initial appointment just skyrocketed. Then they got them back under control, and I don't know exactly how they did that. One other thing, I don't want to sound ominous on this, but I have already seen a couple of hospital systems that have new and much more, I guess I would call them severe policies about seeing uninsured patients. Since everyone is supposed to have insurance, since there's no longer any reimbursement from the federal government, or there will not be soon, for seeing uninsured patients, they have decided that they simply will not provide inpatient care, or they will limit access to people who did not purchase insurance.
Okay.
I always thought there are a lot of stupid things people do. People smoke too much. People drink too much.
People take
drugs. They eat too much. They don't maintain a healthy lifestyle. Those are all stupid. I think not signing up for insurance when you can't afford it is also stupid. I don't know that we single out that stupid and say, I'm not treating that. Because in this country, we do not tell people, if you smoke, I will not treat your heart attack.
Right.
If you drink, I will not.
If you don't wear a helmet.
Right. We, in fact, have a history of treating people no matter what stupid that they subscribe to. We do that, as long as they don't hurt others. If you don't vaccinate your child, then your child is a risk to my child, and you may be denied access to some pediatrician's office. But unless your stupidity affects other people,
right,
in most cases we treat. And this is a whole new idea. Ethically, I don't think we thought through this, but I know there's restrictive policies. That's a concern. Another ripple effect, Rick, you wouldn't think about? Cheaper car insurance.
Because they already switched to Progressive.
No, actually.
15 minutes or less.
Auto insurers in 2007.
That's not Progressive.
They reimbursed $35 billion worth of medical costs for people who were in accidents and didn't have insurance.
Wow.
So if people have insurance, all of a sudden the auto insurance doesn't have to pay for the medical bills. They get it paid under their insurance.
So here's the question. Are the insurance companies competitive enough to where they have to pass that savings on to the customers, or do they just reap profits for a couple of years till people figure it out?
A RAND study released April 15th says the insurance costs may drop by 5%. Now, I looked at the comments, and some people feel like, well, that's just basically people trying to rah-rah about the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, that's not even a good student discount.
Right. Another thing, the Affordable Care Act will cost about $104 billion less over the next decade. That type of projection is almost worthless, but that came from the Congressional Budget Office. They said due to stabilizing health care prices, that it may not be as expensive as it was. There's so many things in motion right now.
Right.
It's very difficult for me to give a grade to the Affordable Care Act just because people have signed up. I think really from my standpoint, I've given you other people's opinions. My personal opinion is I can't tell how this is going to work. There are a lot of concerns I have. There is not a built-in cost control mechanism, except you're just going to make it so hard. People are going to have to pay so much money to see the doctor that they just simply won't do it.
Right.
And I don't think that's necessarily the cost control mechanism I want. Rick, I got a piece of good news, a piece of bad news.
Do I get to pick?
No. Good news first. This was published April 16th, New England Journal of Medicine. Over the past two decades, the rates of diabetes-related complications has fallen dramatically. Rates of heart attack and death from high sugars dropped by two-thirds. Rates of stroke dropped by half. Rates of amputation of the feet due to diabetes dropped by half. The rates of kidney failure dropped by 30%. Now, there's still a higher risk of all those things in people with diabetes.
Okay.
But we are getting better with our medicines, better at managing complications, and so we are at least making some headway in managing our diabetics.
You know, I see a lot more people on insulin pumps these days. Do you think insulin pumps are having a different effect on how we manage our insulin?
Well, I think one thing, you know, we had some really messy medicines that didn't help people's health, and we've learned that metformin is your first choice as far as a pill. As far as the insulin, we have set different targets over the past 20 years. We have started to set our targets at closer to normal sugars. And so those who are on pumps, they're there to try to get their sugars as close to normal as possible. And it appears that there is some benefit, especially in people with what we call type 1 insulin-dependent
right.
diabetes. I think we've learned a lot about diet. I don't want to de-emphasize that. In fact, the diets that we prescribe now are much different than we were 20 years ago. And I think more sensible and more healthy diets for diabetics. But for whatever reason, we are making some progress. Our problem is a lot of the gains will be offset by the fact that we have so many more people who are diabetic that the numbers may not change as much as we hope with that kind of a percentage drop.
So typical, you lead with the good news and we're going to have to end with the bad news.
Absolutely. This was from the Journal of Neuroscience on April 16th as well. It looks like even occasional marijuana smoking produces measurable changes in the appearance of the brain, particularly the nucleus accumbens and the amygdala. These are, according to this, these
hard
are,
to say.
Yeah, that is true. But these are the amygdala and the nucleus accumbens could indicate that marijuana alters brain organization. It may produce changes in function and behavior. There is increasing amounts of marijuana seems to be associated with increasingly severe or increasingly extensive, I'll put it that way. I'll try to be neutral. Brain abnormalities. The area of the brain is responsible for the pleasure center. So we may be enlarging the pleasure center. You say, well, that's a great idea. The problem is it may, in fact, create a need for more marijuana ongoing.
Not necessarily bigger is better here.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I am very concerned about this. I will tell you, I just see some very troubling research related to marijuana. We are about to engage in a massive experiment to find out the effects of marijuana, and I hope that they are not as bad as I fear that they are. Speaking of things I'm afraid of,
And you're going to finally, we're going to end. That's good news, right?
Right. Get us out of here, Rick.
Special thanks to Morehead State Public Radio producers Asa Hosoda and Dispenser Johnson, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
Health Matters has been used for medicinal purposes for thousands of years.
By federal law, the possession of Health Matters is illegal in the United States. However, a growing number of states and the District of Columbia have enacted laws to legalize Health Matters medical use.
The U.S. FDA has not approved Health Matters as a treatment for cancer or any other medical condition.
Radio components of Health Matters, called metarinoids, activate receptors throughout the body to produce effects, particularly in the central nervous system. One such metarinoid is healthabinol. Healthabinol is an FDA-approved to treat loss of appetite in people with AIDS and severe nausea and vomiting caused by cancer chemotherapy.
Healthabinol may be habit-forming and should be heard only by the person it was prescribed for. Healthabinol should never be given to another person, especially someone who has a history of drug addiction or habitual marijuana use. Keep the show in a secure place where others cannot get to it.
Do not use healthabinol if you've ever had an allergic reaction to natural or man-made marijuana. Try telling that to your doctor. Before listening to healthabinol, tell your doctor if you have a seizure disorder, high blood pressure, heart disease, or a history of mental illness or drug addiction, or if you're also using other radio shows that can affect your central nervous system, such as the Front Page.
Boy, he's not going to like that. Healthabinol causes effects that will impair your thinking or reactions. Do not drive or do anything that requires you to be awake and alert until the effects of healthabinol wear off.
Whatever you do, do not take healthabinol or Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for our exciting series on the health benefits of procrastination on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.